is near Spanish Banks. It's the beginning of
Oh,
Spanish
yeah.
Banks.
Across the street from
Yeah,
Lozano
there was
Beach.
an area with a store and a few things, and one of them was called the Jabba Jive, and that's where I first saw Al play. Some sort of a jazz society ran it. And then they later lost that one and opened on West Broadway and they called it the Flat Five. And I played there with a little band called the New Dimension Jazz Trio, which was a bass, marimba, xylophone, bass and drums. It was a very strange band. But this is all during the time when Don Thompson, Terry Clark are there, P.J. Perry, all the big jazz guys were playing there. And Al, of course, had been their mentor, really, since The Cellar in the 50s, when he recorded the album with Kenneth Patch and Beat Poetry and Jazz together, which was actually one of the best albums of its type. It was well received. Downbeat gave it 3 stars. And Dale Hillary was on alto, and Dale was still with Al when I saw him at the Flat Five, Rick Anstey on bass and Jim Chivers on drums. And they would play a tune like Summertime, and they'd stretch it out for a whole set and just go through, you know, cosmic dimensions of sound. And I mean, it wasn't free jazz. It was still kind of rooted in bebop quite heavily, but Al would do things with the changes, and I just wish there was recordings of that stuff. That was amazing, because when we formed our trio with Al shortly after that, I was introduced to Al by Kurt Lang, the late Kurt Lang, who was a poet and painter, old beat figure from Vancouver in the early days with Fred Douglas. They were a famous duo, and I met them way before I met Al, or a year or so before. I was still in high school when I came on the scene in Vancouver, and when it was the little Heidelberg on Robson, and it was UBC, and very small town in those days. It was a village. Everybody knew each other. You knew everybody that had long hair in Kitsilano in the mid-60s. You know, it was before the hippie thing. And this whole period was a very interesting time. It was sort of a beat transformed into, you know, the Carnaby Street influence by 65, 66. That came along. But before that, it was pretty well, you know, modern jazz, modern art, and modern poetry. You know, it was a modernist kind of time. And somehow Al blended all of these together. And Kurt Lang took me down to meet Al in this little house he had on Pendrell Street behind these apartments. And it was kind of like an assemblage, the house itself, with all kinds of stuff on the porch and sculptures. And it would just look like another world, absolutely. And I actually quit university and joined Al. Ended up joining and forming this trio, which actually originally was a quartet. Richard Anstey, again, Rick, showed up on bass, who had been playing with me in this New Dimension Jazz Trio at one point, and so we decided we'd do some playing with Al, and because Rick had already played with them some. And Al was like a legendary figure then in the jazz world here, and been on, you know, CBC a lot, and played behind all kinds of big name people like Art Pepper and Carl Fontana and people that would come up from the States.
So how long had he been playing jazz?
Oh, since the 40s, basically. He was, during the war, he played boogie-woogie piano in Paris during the liberation.
Because he was a gunner in the...
He was in D-Day and got to Paris. And I'm not sure actually where he ended up. I don't think he was part of any drive to Belgium or Berlin or anything, but I know they got him to Paris anyway, which is not a bad destination even in those days, I imagine. Not so fun a place, but anyway, so Al then started The Cellar with Barry Kramer, who later became an intermediate director.
He must have been a young fellow at the time.
Barry was young, yeah, mm-hmm. And they put on plays at The Cellar, like, you know, Crap's Last Tape by Beckett and various, you know, Theater of the Absurd type stuff.
Well, was Kramer like a literary person?
Yeah, he was a guy, you'd call him a guy who really liked music. He loved Frank Sinatra. He loved jazz, and he was the MC actually. So he kind of had a public relations, I think, role. But I have him on a tape actually introducing the Harold Land Quartet at the Cellar in 1958, and I managed to send that tape CD to Harold Land just before he died, and his wife in L.A. And you know, phoned him, and here I am talking to Harold Land, who had played with, you know, Monk and Clifford Brown, and you know, Max Roach, and I'm just going, this is amazing, you know, that this history has come back, and here's Barry on the tape introducing, you know, Cherokee or something, you know, in making jokes and all kinds of stuff. So there's all these links that go back in this kind of very small kind of beat community, which also comprised the New Design Gallery, Alvin Balkan and Abe Rogatnik running that. And, you know, there was only one or two of each thing, one little club and one gallery, and
And they were all connected?
Everybody knew each other. It was just such a small town in those days.
So you'd see Alvin and Abe at the Cellar?
I don't know. I mean, I never went to the Cellar because I was too young in those days. I was still in junior high, you know, basically in the early 60s. But by the mid-60s, I was going to the Flat Five to play. It wasn't a liquor license place, for one thing. For that matter, the Cellar might not have been either. You know, it'd probably bring your own bottle kind of thing. But anyway, Alvin would have, you know, I don't know how into jazz they were, but certainly was the scene all knew each other, you know, and also had that great connection through UBC and Warren Tallman, who had brought in people for readings and for music and put up people like Mingus at his house and, you know, bailed out Danny Richmond when he got busted and, you know, and helped get my drum set to be used by Philly Joe Jones when he came and played at by then the Flat Five had become the Blue Horn. And the Blue Horn Club brought in Mingus and John Handy with the famous group with Don Thompson and Terry Clark. It was an amazing era for jazz, probably the high point of you know, post-bop period.
So there was a major connection between the literary scene and the music scene, obviously, because that was
absolutely
the beatnik kind of connection there.
It was
right?
Amazing. And
jazz
through Warren,
and poetry. And
Jamie Reed. And I did a thing with Jamie Reed and Rick Kataev on piano and Ross Barrett in 1966, a poetry and jazz thing at International House. So this experimenting was going on without it being in any kind of a scene that we thought we were attaching ourselves to. We just did this stuff quite naturally. This was a just natural experimentation. It was the outgrowth of our interests, but we weren't doing it for any kind of market. There was no marketing of this type of thing. Free jazz was just coming in the mid-60s, and that was really changing things. And sort of setting us up for the psychedelic era, which shortly followed, coming from mainly England and San Francisco. We could jump ahead now to the end of 65 when I rented a little storefront on West 4th at Bayswater, one of two.
So you were how old?
18.
Okay.
You know,
just out of high school.
Just out of high school, and having just quit university to play with Al, and thought, well, I better do something. And
You were. You had training as a drummer?
Training as a drummer, 4 or 5 years of piano lessons before the drum lessons, which went on for 3 or 4 years at Jim Blackley's studio, where Terry Clark and Al Wirtz and all these people.
So you must have been like 10 years old when you started music then.
Six.
6 years old. Yeah. Okay, so you've always been
And my mom was a concert singer. She was had perfect pitch. She was a soprano that played with Nicholas Goldsmith, sang with Nicholas Goldsmith and John Avison. We have recordings of that, actually, which I'm trying to remaster. And my dad was an architect, of course, who did the library and a lot of big, he was one of the big architects in the late 40s, early 50s, right through the 50s.
So you lived in a kind of bohemian
kind of
atmosphere.
Yeah, not really bohemian, pretty well off. In my first 10 years of life, I was extremely well off. My father was making $50,000 a year profit in the mid-50s after he paid his office off. And he went through it, though.
So were you rebelling against anything there?
Not at all, no.
No,
no, I still haven't rebelled yet. I'm hoping to one day.
So all of this was just an extension of the creativity that you were...
Yeah, it was just a creative
surrounded by at home.
Yeah, I was, although, you know, my dad left when I was 11. So even though I wasn't actually into becoming an artist quite at that point, but 3 or 4 years later, mainly through the influence of my older brother, Barry, who was at UBC starting to be an architect, and he would bring home books on the Bauhaus and Vision and Motion by Moholy Nagy and, you know, things like that. And I kind of got intrigued as I got older. And I was painting, just doing little, you know, paint by numbers. Or actually, I remember, interestingly, I was doing copies of other paint by number ones that you could buy. There was a little catalog that had little thumbnails of farm scenes and stuff, so I do little copies of those. Would actually buy the paint by numbers, you know. So I started copying the copyists, you know. And anyway, within a few years, I got very interested in surrealism and decided I'd, you know, become a painter and artist. I was doing collages and all kinds of stuff.
So was this around the same time? Was this coming together at the same time the music was coming together?
It
in 65?
Yeah, 64. I was playing already in the jazz clubs in grade 12. So I'd been playing a little bit commercially as well, just a little bit, and you know, getting my feet wet in the scene. And then by the time I got the studio, which I sort of rented as a painting studio, but then I guess I thought in the back of my mind, well, we could also rehearse there. So we got a piano, and I went over to see Gordon Bell, who had the pickup truck, one of the famous pickup trucks, and Pete Choquette, who was sharing a place with him. And we got the piano moved. We rented a piano from a local piano store and moved it in there to the place. It was freezing cold. We had a space heater. And I was drawing and painting from the model there. I had Wendy Newman. Do you know Wendy? From the, she used to run the Vancouver East Cultural Center.
Oh, really?
Yeah. She was a real girlfriend of one of my friends, Scott Lawrence, a poet that lived up the street in West Van. And so I was doing art there, but then to maintain this place, we had Richard's neighborhood friends, and this is, you know, we're all still teenagers, basically, late teens, and these people would come so they could hang out there. Mike Coots and other friends, Harley McConnell, they'd chip in a bit towards rent, which is only $60 a month or something like that, but it was still a fair amount for those days. But we had a whole storefront, and we put a space heater in it and got the piano in there.
Did you have a license?
No, we weren't open to any. It was just a private studio at that point. I should say, though, that this Al Neal Trio did have a quartet, two rehearsals at the beginning as a quartet, with Bob Buckley playing alto sax. Bob Buckley of Spring fame, and, you know, he's now a big rock producer, composer. So that only lasted two rehearsals, and then we formed the trio and started rehearsing at that sound gallery, and which was just a big empty storefront. And it was quite echoey, but we did record in there, and that's on the CD, the double CD. And down the street, where Intermedia now sort of first enters the picture in the formative stages was down at 4th and Blenheim, was another similar studio to what we had. And it was Sam Perry and Jerry Walker. Jerry Walker was an electronic composer and piano, prepared piano, all that type of stuff. And he was at UBC at the time. And Sam Perry, who was a filmmaker and optical experimenter. And they were working in quite independently of us down the block. But at a certain point, we went and saw them. And I think that's where I maybe first met Gary Leonova. And I'd seen his show of hexagon paintings out at UBC, which blew my mind totally and changed my art completely. And
the hard edge
updated
stuff.
Me to, you know, because I was already doing geometric painting with cubes and all kinds of shapes like that. But he brought this sort of pop Carnaby Street element from England, from his studies in England. So that was a big influence, seeing Claude Breeze shows, Jack Wise, Audrey Dory, Joy Long, all these exhibitions, Brian Fisher. So these were the hot artists of the time, right? They were the young artists, Michael Morris. And, you know, Paul Wong got the Bauchi going in 67. Anyway, I'm jumping ahead. Back to 65 and 66, early 66, after a break of a month where Richard and I went up to Banff to play in this crazy mountain home lodge place, sort of a commercial jazz trio gig or quartet with a sax player, Nick McGowan. We came back in February, and by March, we decided to get together with Sam and Jerry and other people that were working there, like Dallas Selman and Gary Leonova, and have put on some kind of event down at our sound gallery.
Who was Jerry?
Jerry Walker, the electronic composer. So Jerry would do a little piece, the Al Neal Trio would play, and Sam would project lights. And I think very early on we had some dancers as well, and Judith Copperthorne was one of the first. I'd already met Judy doing life drawing classes. She was a model at UBC in the life drawing class. You know, this is the way they interfaced, you know, intersected scenes. So she did, I remember one thing, it was the seagull dance, where she was sort of flying and having these projections of seagulls on her. It sounds hokey in a way, but it was incredibly poetic at the time. It was one of the hits. And they're kind of a wall of, you know.
Well, this hadn't been done a lot. I mean, this whole idea of having, you know, bodies with
not
projection,
here.
In conjunction with projection.
Exactly.
Not here, you say,
yeah.
But it had been done,
maybe in the
and it
US
was being done in the U.S. on the East
a little
Coast.
Just starting. I think there was that group that Sam knew about called USCO, Steve Durkee. And then there was some playwrights, the coach with the Six Inside, Gene Erdman, and I believe Helen Goodwin studied with Gene Erdman. So there was a connection to these people in the U.S. who were doing some experimental work. And Sam, of course, hadn't made his movies in Tibet, and he had these kind of double exposure things with mandalas and Tibetan sunsets and, you know, I mean, amazing kind of footage, which is all a lot. We don't know, nobody knows where any of the stuff is now.
So was Helen then involved in this early,
not yet,
these early experiments?
But she probably came along fairly soon, because by 66, we'd been doing this for a few months, and it was really getting attention. People were flocking to this place, paying a donation to sit there on the floor on cushions. We were getting write-ups. Anyway, so by, I think it was June of 66, we'd outgrown this place. And so Helen somehow had become involved through maybe through the dancers, and she formed her dance company, which eventually was called the WECO Dancers, because Sam had formed WECO Projection, a prototype of light shows before there was anything called a light show. In the summer of 66, we did the Trips Festival, which was the biggest single event that ever happened, including anything in intermediate. This was huge. This was Big Brother and the Holding Company. Janis Joplin doing her first out-of-town or any concert with that band. She flew in to play her first gig with Big Brother, and it was in Vancouver at the Trips Festival, and the Alan Neal Trio opened for her. 100 screens around the Garden Auditorium being rear-projected by Sam and his crew. We also did the Afterthought Light Show at the, or Afterthought Music and Light Show at the Pender Auditorium during this period. So I was doing some work on light shows as well, which weren't called light shows then. That didn't start till the Retinal Circus. Then they were calling them light shows, because I think that was a San Francisco term that had caught on by then in the Fillmore and all this type of thing, you know. At the Trips Festival, the Grateful Dead was there. Jerry Garcia and Janis jammed, you know, playing these kind of interlocking lines where she was sort of singing atonal stuff and just, you know, amazing. Quicksilver, Daily Flash, all these bands. Michael McClure there reading poetry. Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters. And they crashed with their bus in the back of our new studio, which was called Motion Studio on Seymour Street, 1266. And, you know, I didn't know who they were. I'd never even heard of them. One flew over the cuckoo. None of this had happened yet, you know. The Magic Bus was sort of known as a Bay Area cult phenomenon, the way these bands had been. But nobody knew them up here, really. I didn't know much about them. Anyway, to describe the Motion Studio, though, which Helen's husband, who was with Bell Irving, her husband Michael, rented this place for us. He got it for us. It was really funky, but there was a lot of room in it, a lot of space. Jerry Walker lived upstairs, and Jerry, the electronic composer, also built a cage out of that rebar, I think it is, with the holes in it, you know, mm-hmm. that steel cage in the middle of the big performance space that was at the back. And he sat up in there with a joystick and swirled the sound around speakers.
Oh, angle iron.
Angle iron stuff, yeah, with the holes in it. And it was all bolted together, and he sat up in there. It was just amazing. And then at the back was a three-tiered projection tower that had been built with all of these liquid projections, magic lantern slides, movies, everything they could find, and just hit the wall with a barrage of stuff that was about 2 miles deep.